Now, what's the problem with prevention? Two things. First, you can never prevent all attacks. Some attacks are always going to sneak in, so detection is always going to be able to catch anything your preventive measures might have missed. Second, preventive measures block and stop and can impact things from occurring. If you're going in and you have sensors in a area that's monitoring a critical process that can impact safety, and you deploy a firewall that inadvertently or accidentally blocks those messages, and now you have a valve that's stuck and it's not opening like it should, and you're having pressure build up, and those sensors are sending the message back to the HMI, but your firewall's blocking it, so your HMI's never getting it, what's going to eventually happen? There's going to be an explosion or a safety impacting event, and you didn't know about it because your firewall stopped those events from getting there. Therefore, while we are going to use them, preventive measures can be very dangerous in a control system environment, because if it blocks or stops critical activity, it can blind you from what's occurring. So therefore, a lot of our strategy is let's do minimal prevention and let's focus on timely detection. Let's put a lot of our energy and effort to be able to catch and find those anomalies quick and fast. Now, anomaly analysis becomes easier and effective in more stable environments. The more stable the environment, the easier it is to snap a profile of normalcy and catch anomalies that are occurring. The more complex and dynamic an environment, the harder it is to spot anomalies, because if the environment is naturally changing, then you don't know if a deviation or anomaly is the normal activity or if it's an adversary or an attacker. Now, what's the negative that we're going to turn into a positive in control systems? The negative that we're going to turn into a positive in control systems is control systems are very static, controlled environments. That's why we can't patch. That's why we can't harden. That's why we can't lock down. So when it comes to host level protection, the fact that our control environments are very rigid is a negative. However, when it comes to detection and logging, that negative becomes a positive, because now we have a steady state baseline that's easy to monitor. And now anytime an adversary does anything, that deviation is going to stick out, be very obvious, and now we can get a very robust, rich detection capability just by keeping detailed logs and analysis of what's happening within an organization. I love setting up SIMs and logging and analysis in control system environments because it doesn't make your head explode. When I try setting up SIMs and log management for financial clients and regular organizations, oh, it's going to make you nuts, because there's no baseline. Everything's changing. There's no control. There's no such thing as normal. They're adding and removing and changing and doing all that crazy stuff, that it's a really, really difficult task. But here, it's easy to snap against that baseline. So that's why we have a module focused in on the logging and events and correlation, because that's in essence going to give us that detection insight, and that's our main security. In other environments, we try to prevent everything with a little detection. In control systems, we prevent a little with a lot of detection. So the primary logging facility in Unix is syslog. Syslogd is the syslog daemon that's going to be monitoring, watching, and tracking all the activity occurring on our system. And then we use the syslog.conf file to tell what to log, where to log, and the severity of those associated logs. Now, there's some good news, bad news here. Syslog is a standard. So if you're running different varieties of Linux and different varieties of Unix that are syslog, they will all be following the same standard. You have your date, your time, the originator, M. Jackson, went in and used the pluggable authentication module. They opened the session for root, which is UID 0, from a normal user. So that's the general formatting that will always be followed. Here's the negative. The syslog standard is too general, which means you can have two systems that are both syslog compatible, but you can't cross-correlate the logs. Let me explain. Syslog says the first field must be a date. Syslog doesn't tell you what format to use. So here is four different date formats from four different Linux configs on control systems. All four of those are syslog compatible. All of those are fully compliant with syslog. Try to correlate those logs. Not going to be happening. You're going to mix match and you're going to get garbage out of it, which means if you're doing correlation, which you absolutely need to be, what do you have to do in order to correlate the logs from multiple sources? You have to go in and convert all of the dates to a unified format. Now, great. All of your tools like Nitro, Splunk, ArcSight can do that for you. So they can go in and they can receive the logs. They can change the date. They can put everything in a consistent format so you can do correlation and analysis. What's the problem? What's another word for logs? Evidence. That's your evidence if you ever go to litigation. And in some control system environments, nuclear, utilities, and others, you're litigating a lot. There's lawsuits, there's others. What's the problem if you're now automatically changing the dates so you can cross-correlate in your sim? You've just altered the evidence and you've impacted the admissibility within a court of law. So now we have this dilemma that if we alter the logs so we can correlate, we've impacted our admissibility of evidence. And if we don't alter so we have good evidence, we can't correlate and analyze to see what's happening. Solution? You must, in a control system environment, break out correlation and aggregation. The problem is a lot of environments will aggregate the logs, modify and correlate on a single box. That's dangerous because if you don't modify, you can't correlate. And if you do modify to correlate, you're going to aggregate modified logs that are not admissible in court. The trick is you got to have two separate servers. You got to have one server that receives all the logs and it digitally signs and backs it up. And then that log needs to send it to a separate server that's going to go in and correlate, change, and alter so you can analyze and see what's happening within your environment. Those two functions need to be separate because they have contradictory goals. The goal of your aggregator is to back up and digitally sign without any modification. The goal of your correlator is to alter consistent format to look for patterns of activity. Because they contradict and because syslog doesn't have a standardized unified format, our only acceptable solution is to go in and break that function out into two separate areas. That is one of the biggest mistakes that we see made with our clients. They want everything on a single server and they make one of two mistakes. They either don't modify the logs so they're not cross-comparable and you get garbage, or they modify and you don't have evidence if you go to litigation. So because control system environments, often depending on what industry you're in, can be heavily litigated, you got to break it out into one for backing up digitally signing evidence and one for altering and correlating the data. Two separate servers. Eric, isn't it a little more expensive? Yes, but not that much expensive and not expensive enough to justify sacrificing one or the other to accomplish our goals. Two separate devices. As I mentioned, syslogd is the centralized logging daemon, and then it has a configuration file in etcsyslog.conf that tells Syslog what to log, where to log, and the importance of the respective logs. So the way this is working is you have all your facilities. Anything that's running on a Linux system is a facility. Authentication, INetD, kernel, user processes, all of those are facilities that can generate logs. They're going to pass everything to Syslog. Syslog's going to look at its configuration file and determine where to send the respective logs from a aggregation and correlation perspective. So if you go into syslog.conf, it really has three sections. First section is the facility, what's generating a log. The second is what's the criticality of the log. And the third is what action do you want to take? Do you want to store locally? Do you want to pop up a message? Do you want to store remotely? A asterisk in your config file is a wildcard. So here it's saying any facility that's generating an alert, go to the root. Here it's saying mail of any level, go to the log mail log. So if you see a star, it's just a wildcard that's inclusive of all activity within that respective category. As I mentioned, your facilities can be anything that's running on the system. It can be authentication. It can be any daemons or services that are running. It can be your kernel. Heck, Syslog can generate messages. Your mail, anything on that box that's running or performing a function can generate log messages. The level is what is the importance of this message. Is it an emergency? I always love this one. It is now time to panic, right? So you can have an emergency or panic. You can have errors, warnings, information, or debug. And then the action is where do you want the messages to go? For all important information, you always want to send it to a remote logging host, which is done with the @ symbol followed by an IP address. So for all critical logs, you want to send them to a remote syslog server. Now you can send it to multiple remote syslog servers. So you can have @IP address, @IP address, @IP address. Where this becomes beneficial is in your control system environment, you might have different levels of visibility you want. So for example, you might have certain logs be sent to the local facilities log server. So you're going to have a local operational staff that's going to be looking at monitoring and tracking that activity. Then you might have certain log messages go to that logging facility, but it might also go to another logging that generates alerts for your field technicians if devices are not operating correctly, so you can deploy somebody to go in and look at, repair, or determine what's happening. And then you might also send certain log messages to your centralized enterprise logging server so you can do correlative analysis to look for any large-scale patterns, attacks, or advanced threats that might be occurring or happening within your organization. So you literally can design out a very strategic, centralized, or distributed setup that correlates and analyzes logs across different areas and different places within our environment. We absolutely want to do centralized logging, and there's two reasons why we do it. Reason one, if we have a system or server in our environment and we think it might be compromised, we think it might be broken into and somebody might have access to it, how do we determine and find out if that is true or not? By looking at the logs. But wait a second. If we're concerned that a server might be compromised and the only proof of what the adversary did is on the server itself, what could a good adversary do? Modify, alter, or change the logs, which means the longer the logs stay on the server, the less valuable they are to us and the more likely that they get altered or modified and not show us what's really happening. So if the logs are going to be the signs of life of an adversary doing harmful things, we got to get those logs off that server as quick as possible. We got to pull it off that box as fast as we can to minimize the chance of an adversary doing anything harmful. That's reason one. Reason two, in this day and age, we have to be able to do correlation. Looking at individual logs is going to be too voluminous, and it's not going to give us the insight we need. So the only way we can correlate across a large area is by pulling those logs together in a centralized fashion to be able to analyze, correlate, and determine what's happening and looking for patterns and or anomalies. So now that we've gone in and we've looked at the Unix logging, we understand what to look for and how to configure and set it up. We have our last module of the day, which is before we jump into the lab, which is where we look at third-party enhancements and utilities for Linux-based systems. Before we jump in to that final module, are there any questions, comments, concerns, anything we went over on logging? Question. Okay, so one important point to bring up is if we're sending our log messages to a remote syslog server, it's generating network traffic. And depending on the type of systems, what you're logging, and the activity level, it can generate a lot of traffic. So one of the risks you always have is if you're not careful with what you're logging and how you're logging, it could actually generate large amounts of network traffic that could potentially flood, cause performance issues or other problems or other issues within our environment. So there's a few ways of handling it. One way is going in and having an out-of-band network for logging from our different servers. So if we go back to our earlier slide, remember when we set up, we had a slide earlier today where we talked about logging and we essentially said you're going to go to the field device and you're going to upload to the supervisory control. From there, you're going to upload to our DMZ. To the DMZ, you're going to upload to the business network where we're going to manage, correlate, and analyze the logs. And we said we can use data diodes to control the flow of information. That is absolutely one way of going in and being able to get the logs in our environment. However, we are using the production bandwidth and we could be flooding our network. Another alternative is to put a separate NIC, network interface card, in each of our critical servers and actually have one network for production and a separate network for logging. So literally we have an entire separate network that's nothing but logging. So this way bandwidth won't be an issue. Bandwidth won't be a problem because we're using a separate out-of-band network in order to do that communication. In a lot of environments, there is so much wiring that's underutilized in all the locations that this actually isn't an expensive solution. So if you're like most of our clients that went crazy with wiring and there's so much Category 5, 6 wiring flying around that's so underutilized, just throw another network interface card in there, set up a separate network, and that's an easy way of doing it. The second way, which is not as ideal, but we're trying to get good enough in some cases, is back to your scenario where let's say that computer A is trying to talk to computer B, and it shouldn't be allowed, and it's just flood, 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 and we've told the vendor they're researching it, but we just want to ignore it. Yeah, we could go in to our SIM console. I can go into my Splunk, Nitro, Arc site, and I could tell it to ignore. Problem is it's still generating all the bandwidth on the network. So therefore, what we often do is we have logging agents that we install on all of our servers. And then when we go in and say ignore, what we would now do is tell the local logging agent, listen, every 50,000 times you see this, send us a log, but don't send us all the individual logs. We know about it. Don't worry about it. So now your logging agent is going to be blocking it at the local system so it's never sent out across the network. So really the three options you have is option one is just block and ignore at your SIM console, but you're going to generate tons of network traffic. That's the simplest though. Second is to have an out-of-band logging network. Now you don't have to worry about bandwidth because you're using a separate isolated segment. That requires some configuration and setup, but works well. And the third option is install agents on all of your systems that will do the local filtering so the traffic never ever gets sent out across the network. So those would be three solutions that would scale and work fairly well. If there's no other questions, let's question one more. All right. Sorry about that. No, it's great. Question is, if you have a standalone system that's not configured correctly and it's going out and it's looking for the AV console to try to pull down system devices, but it's not there because it's meant to be standalone, is that all right? And it depends on your definition of all right. Is it going to have any major impact on the functioning of the network? Is it going to cause any major impact to the ability for that box to perform its job function? Probably not. But my two concern factors are, one, you're generating a lot of extra traffic, which not only can have a performance issue, but it's also going to make it harder for me to find anomalous traffic because you're generating noise. And anytime there's noise, adversaries can hide within that noise. So I would go back and say, okay, can we either locally with a firewall or add a switch, try to at least block or stop that so we're not just generating unnecessary traffic? My second concern would be AV only works if you're getting updates, because AV is typically signature-based security, and it's only as good as the signatures. So my concern is, if you're running AV software for compliance reasons and it's trying to go out to the network to get updates and it can't because it's standalone and you don't have any other out-of-band way of updating those signatures, that effectiveness of that AV software is going to decline rapidly over time. And in 6, 9, 12 months, that AV software is going to be very, very ineffective and you're giving yourself a false sense of security. Okay. So what it comes down to is, it is sloppy. It's not going to make it as easy for you to analyze, but it's probably not going to impact production. However, the more you do that and the more sloppy you get with installations and you have more things generating more noise and more activity, you could start getting a compounding effect that could either make it really hard to find out what's happening, make it really hard to analyze traffic, or impact bandwidth. Because the other thing you got to remember is you have to store your logs. So if you have a lot of devices that are generating bogus, unnecessary traffic, hard drive space isn't free, and you're going to be storing a lot of unnecessary traffic there. So I would either at a host or at a switch try to at least block or clean it up to minimize that overall impact on it. But if you're asking me, is it a major, major problem for productivity? Probably not. Could it cause issues down the road? Absolutely. All right. So if there's no other questions, let's go ahead and take a look at our last section where we're going to look at some of the additional utilities that we can install and put on our Linux system. It's sort of funny and humorous to me how organizations are so focused on installing security software on Windows boxes, but they very rarely do that on Linux boxes. This is sort of a small crowd, but if I did a survey, and when I go on site to our clients, and I ask them, how many of your Windows boxes has endpoint security, security protection, and security controls in place? It's probably in the upper 90%. If I go in and ask how many of your Linux boxes and Linux systems have endpoint security, it's probably in the single digits. It boggles my mind, but for some reason, people believe that only Windows needs endpoint security protection and Linux does not. Anything on your network can be targeted. Anything on your network can be broken into, and because controlled system environments tend to have more Linux boxes. We need to make sure that we have proper endpoint security in place to lock down, control, and protect the environment. So we're going to finish up by looking at some integrity checkers, host-based firewalls, and other tools that we can use for increasing, securing, and locking down our system. One of the fundamental but effective ways of securing a system is by looking for any unauthorized modifications that might be occurring in our environment. The tool for doing this is the general category of tools known as FIC. FIC is file integrity checking, and this way file integrity checking works is it goes in and it takes cryptographic hashes of key files, stores them in a secure location, then at set intervals, it reruns the cryptographic hash and compares them. If they're the same, everything's good. If they're different, we now know there's been an unauthorized modification on our system. And it's a pretty simple concept, but it's extremely, extremely effective if it's tuned correctly, because I don't care how stealthy, I don't care how advanced an adversary is, they are going to have to change files on your system. They're going to have to in order to upload code, run processes, and do other things. So by going in and carefully creating a database of the cryptographic hashes of all your key files, rerunning it at set intervals is a very, very easy, effective, scalable way of looking for any unauthorized changes or modifications within your environment. Important, as with any security technology, it only works if it's configured correctly. So if you go in and you don't tripwire the right files, or you do too many that you get so many false positives, it's not going to work correctly. But if you systematically figure out all the files that shouldn't change, nothing more, nothing less, and you carefully protect those files, you can actually have a very good way of detecting and finding adverse activity within your environment. Next is Linux has full firewall capability built in. The way we do that is with a product called IP tables. IP tables is a full stateful packet filtering firewall, and you can go in and you can create rules to allow or drop traffic within your environment. So here, I'm setting this up as a personal firewall. I'm saying any traffic that's coming into this box, I'm going to allow TCP port 22, which is SSH. So I'm going to allow SSH connections into our system, and then I'm going to block everything else within our environment. Now, one of the advantages of personal firewalls is you can do more configuration and the impact is minimized if you make a mistake. If I go in and I have a corporate network firewall that's sitting between 5,000 systems on my supervisor control network and I inadvertently block or stop traffic that should be allowed through, I've just impacted 5,000 boxes. I've just caused major, major production issues in our organization. But if I go in and I start blocking traffic at an individual host and I made a mistake, if I impact one system, that's recoverable. If I impact 5,000, it's not. But Eric, now only one system is protected. Yes, but what can I do? I can't really easily incrementally roll out a network firewall rule set. I guess you could technically go in and write a rule for one IP and then add in two IPs and then add in three IPs, but that's going to be ridiculous, drive you crazy, and not manageable. So there's really no simple, reasonable, scalable way that you can roll out a firewall rule set that systematically blocks small numbers to large numbers. However, you can with personal firewalls. I could write the rule set deployed on one system. Everything works great. roll it out to 5 systems. Everything works great, roll it out to 20 systems. So now, based on the criticality and importance of those systems, utilizing personal firewalls can give us a more scalable, lower risk, higher level of security to control, minimize, and stop traffic patterns flowing in and out of our network. And yes, you can use IP tables as a network level firewall also. So you can go in and be able to write a rule set that says anything coming into the box, we're going to do stateful filtering. We're going to allow HTTP and SSL for web traffic. We're going to allow mail. We're going to allow DNS traffic, and we're going to allow anyone to SSH into our system. Now, here's something cool about Linux. In Windows, personal firewalls and network firewalls are two different products. They're often made by different companies, and they're totally incompatible in rule sets and how they're set up. So I have to go in and I have to write completely different configuration files for network firewalls as I have to with host firewalls in a Windows environment. Notice in Linux, I'm using the same product for both. The only difference is the action. If I go in and I make my action input, that's a personal level firewall. And if I go in and I make my action forward, that's a network level firewall. Other than that, I'm using the same product in both cases. That means I can go in and take rule sets between the personal and the network and make them cross compatible. So now I could literally design rule sets once and I could use them both at a personal and a network level. And from a scalability and verification perspective, this gives us a much higher level of operational capability by having a single product that can perform both roles. And therefore, I have interchangeable rule sets that I can use back and forth between the two systems. Another technique question. Excellent question. So the question is, what's the difference between IP tables and IP chains? IP chains is a packet filtering firewall, and IP tables is a stateful packet filtering firewall. So IP chains came out first, and it's packet filtering only. It looks at each packet with no other information and makes a block or allow decision. Packet filtering firewalls are very fast, but they're not very secure, because they can't correlate across packets. You're looking at each packet independently with no other information and making a block or allow decision. IP tables is IP chains with a stateful analysis added on top of it. So now we're taking the packet filtering of IP chains and we're adding a state table where now I can cross correlate packets and make better, more informed decisions. So IP tables provides a higher level of security than IP chains, but it's slower because now I have to correlate and analyze packets. So IP chains is packet filtering. IP tables is stateful packet filtering that's built on top of IP chains. The next trick that we use for securing, locking down, and protecting our environments is something called a cherooted environment. Cherooted is sandboxing. So the idea of a cherooted environment is I'm going to go in and I'm going to create a sandbox. This directory, this subdirectory, and that's the only area this executable can run in. So now think about it. If I go in and I'm running an executable and I'm cherooting it to /home/eric/tools. So the only thing the tool has access to is that subdirectory. It can't read or write anything else other than /home/eric/tools. I'm sandboxing it to that specific area. How are you going to do harm on my box if you can't read or write outside of /home/eric/tools? You can't. So now by cheruting or sandboxing and limiting a program to run to a specific directory or subdirectories, it's not able to survive a reboot. It's not able to do overwrite files. It's not able to do a lot of harmful things. So you're containing and controlling it to a limited area. However, before we get too excited, a lot of programs are not capable of running in a cheruted environment. Why? Because in order to run in a cheruted environment, every file, every library, every module that you touch, write, or need have to be in that directory. A lot of programs today are using shared libraries. They're using shared subroutines. They're using shared components, which means if your program is not self-contained and uses libraries and modules, as many of them do, trying to cheroot them can be very, very difficult, very, very hard, and almost impossible. So I throw it out there that if you have self-contained executables, which in many cases you might, going in and cherooting is great. However, if you're using a lot of shared libraries and modules, you might not be able to use this trick. Not every trick is going to work in every case, but I'm just giving you a lot of different solutions so you have a lot of different options at your disposal to try out in your environment. Kernel level rootkits are very, very common in Unix Linux environments. A kernel level rootkit is where you infect the kernel with malicious code to give you back false information about your system so you can't identify that your system's been compromised. Kernel level rootkits are very, very hard to detect, but there are programs out there like Check Rootkit and Rootkit Hunter that will go in and look for indications of a kernel level rootkit and be able to tell you if you're infected on your box. So it's not a bad idea to run these tools periodically to see if there's any indications, warnings, or unusual activity that might be indicative of a rootkit. I briefly talked about hardening guides this morning, and I'm going to elaborate. A hardening guide is typically an executable that you download, you install it on your computer, and it hardens, locks down, and secures your system. Now, I have a fundamental problem with most rootkits. And the two fundamental problems I have is this. So you go out to the internet, you find some hardening guide, you download it, you run it on your system, it comes back and says, you are secure. Great. Have you really helped your security position? Now, you might be able to argue a little bit that running a hardening guide protects you better than not running it. But my fundamental problems are this. What are you going to tell your executives? You have no metrics. You have no quantitative data. You have no idea what that guy did. And second, you have no clue what it really secured. You haven't learned anything. You don't know what vulnerabilities were fixed. You don't have what exposures were there. So great. You ran this hardening guide, but you have no idea what it did, and you have no idea how it improved your position. So now if your executives come and say, okay, how's our security? Great. How has it been compared to last month? Oh, we improved a lot. Well, how do you know? Well, I downloaded some random script that I ran on our servers. Well, what did the random script do? I have no clue, but it made us secure. Yeah, if you were the CIO or CSO, I would be escorting you out of the building. Because you just told me that you took one of our critical production infrastructure items that's supporting mission critical applications in our environment, and you randomly ran code that you have no freaking clue what it did, and you can't tell me anything about security, and you're my security officer, I'd rather take my chances. You're not really helping yourself here. So to me, if you're going to be running hardening guides, they need to meet one of two requirements. They either need to give you quantitative data so you can do comparative analysis, or they need to teach you about security. Therefore, based on that analysis, the two hardening guides that I recommend are the CIS Hardening Guide and Bastille Linux. CIS Hardening Guide gives you a numeric score for your system. So now it's going to go in and it gives you quantitative data. So now by running the CIS Hardening Guide, your executives can say, okay, are we improving security? Yes. How do you know? Because last quarter we had an average score of 40 and this quarter we have an average score of 55. Last quarter we had 8 systems that scored below 30. This quarter we have no systems that score below 30. So now all of a sudden we have quantitative data that we can use to do comparative analysis across our systems. My second favorite is Bastille. Bastille is written by a friend of mine, Jay Beal, and Bastille teaches you about security. So Bastille isn't going to go in, randomly run, and say you're done. It's going to take you through an iterative process. So when you run Bastille, which I'll show you, it's going to be our last lab. We're going to run about 5 slides. Bastille will take you through the hardening process, explain to you what it's doing, and give you the chance to decide what decisions you want to make. Now, yes, Bastille might take 30, 40 minutes when a regular hardening guide takes 3 minutes, but when you get done with Bastille, you have a clue. It teaches you and shows you how to secure a Linux box. That's why it's our capstone, because the Bastille lab has a twofold benefit. Not only is it showing you how to run the tool and how to harden your system, but if you actually go through and read the slides, it's actually teaching you about Linux security. So it's almost a tutorial that we're going to use to wrap up today to show you all the critical pieces that are needed to lock down your system. Finally, we want to be able to go in and harden our box as much as possible. We want to do that before we go into production. So the first recommended option is, can you go in and install a secure version of Linux? If you can go in and install your own version of Linux, we recommend SE Linux. SE Linux is a completely rewritten, hardened, locked down version of Linux that has very granular discretionary access control, very detailed security auditing, and also mandatory access control built in order to support multi-level secure environments within your organization. So if you can build your version of Linux from scratch, SE Linux is the way to go. What if you can't? What if you have an existing version of Linux and you can't rebuild it from scratch? Next question, can you replace the kernel? If you can replace the kernel, we use GR Security Kernel. The GR Security Kernel is the kernel that's built in to SE Linux and can provide a higher level of protection and control. So question one is, can you install Linux from scratch, SE Linux? If you can't install from scratch, can you replace the kernel, GR Security Kernel? And if you can't do either of those, then we use AppArmor. AppArmor can work with any version of Linux, and it will harden, lock down, and secure the system, very similar to SE Linux and GR Security Kernel, but it doesn't require a reinstall or a replacement of the kernel. In control system environments, these have to be done before deployment. You're not going to be able to go into production systems and start rebuilding, swapping out kernels, and reinstalling the hardening process. This has to be done prior to acceptance testing, so your box will be in a good, secure state before deployment. So now that we've finished up and we've looked at some of the additional mechanisms we can use for securing and locking down our system, I'd like to wrap up the day by opening up our lab book to page 65. So if we take our ICS 410 workbook and we open up to page 65, it's going to go in and we're going to show you how to run Bastille Lennox. Now, remember, this lab has a double benefit. Not only are you going to learn to run the tools like you did yesterday, but we want you to go through, read the screens, and look at what it's telling you, because not only are you going to learn about the tool, but it's also going to give you a tutorial about Lennox security. So Bastille Lennox is like you're almost watching a little video that's showing you the steps that are needed to be able to control file permissions, security, authentication, and many applications like SendMail and Apache on your system. It works with most of the vendor products and is fairly flexible. So you're going to go in and read through the intro pages, and then on page 70 is where you start. It's very easy. You're going to go in and you're going to start up Samurai. Once Samurai is running, you're going to go in and you're going to click on the terminal window icon right here. So you're going to click there, and that's going to open up a terminal window. Once the terminal window is up and running, you're going to just type sudo Bastille on your system with dash dash report and then hit enter. So this is going to be the final report that you run at the end. Sorry, I got a little ahead of myself. You're going to do that once you finish running it. The first thing you want to do is type sudo Bastille, and that's going to actually run the actual program. So if you go in and actually run this program, it's now going to take you through the process. So you're going to say okay, and here we go. It's going to talk about, would you like to set more restrictive permissions? It's going to tell you what those permissions are. You're going to decide whether yes or no for those permissions, and then you're going to click on to the next area. So literally what we're going to have you do in this lab is we're going to have you go through, set up Bastille on your system, read through the notes, run Bastille. It's going to take you through this questionnaire process, and then at the end you're going to view the report and be able to do the analysis. This typically takes about 30 minutes to run. We right now are at 5 o'clock, and we're scheduled to end at 5:30. So we're actually set up perfectly for where we want to be. So go ahead and start. Go through and read the background. Follow the process for setting up and running Bastille. And then it will go in and show you each of the different hardening steps and the process to go through. So we literally walk you screen through screen, showing you how to do the analysis and in essence teaching you how to secure and learn about Lennox security. Then we are done with the lecture. So once you're done with the lab, you're free to go. And then we will start tomorrow morning with book 4, and we will go through defending ICS systems from a network level. So tomorrow is when we talk about firewalls, IDSs, and crypto within our environment.